Welcome to another edition of Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And this is episode 2 of our ongoing analysis of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. Today we're going to be looking at the 2008 smash hit, The Dark Knight. Not much background about this film. Batman Begins did well enough for Warners that they greenlit the sequel. Nolan wrote it with his brother Jonathan, and story work was also done by Goyer. All the major players are returned except for Katie Holmes, who was replaced by Maggie Gyllenhaal. This is a long film, so let's get going. So the film opens with silence over the credits. We're getting the very first part of this film, we get the Joker's theme, which is this single-held string, which is in many of the scenes that the Joker's in or has caught, you know, or around, becomes his theme. It's very effective music cue, as it were. The opening segment of the movie I call The Bank Job. And it's basically the Joker, you know, robbing a bank. And we start with the camera zooming in to this building in broad daylight. Really beautifully shot. I think there's a lot of IMAX camera work in this opening scene. But two masked men shoot a zip line across a span of buildings. And they kind of, you know, zip over to the roof of the bank. And it's a really beautiful shot. The camera swings by overhead. Just the way this moment is shot, we see a lot of the city. It really gives the film an initial scope. And we really recognize that we're in an epic movie already. There's a lot, I think, this sequence owes to Michael Mann's film Heat, in particular the bank job in Heat. So there's a couple of little things, and I'll talk about them as we go through. Then we quickly cut to an unknown man standing on a street corner, and basically he's holding a clown mask facing backwards, and we're seeing him from the back, and it's the mask of the Joker, obviously, and this is the Joker. It's the first time we're seeing him, but we don't know it yet, but it's a very chilling shot. Basically, the bank job strategies, there are three guys that take the front door. There are two guys on the roof disabling the alarm. Initially, now, we're introduced to the Joker's strategy about how he's going to sort of eliminate his team. It's very clever, chilling and clever at the same time. Basically, when each guy fulfills his part of the job, the guy with him kills him. First guy to die is the guy who prevents the alarm from sounding. So once they break in, someone sounds a silent alarm, the guy on the roof tricks it out. And basically the guy behind him kills him. And then we cut to into the bank. We see this bank manager, and he's played by an actor named William Fichtner. And I can't imagine this was unintentional given, you know, this sequence. So then we have a shot of two men drilling into the vault, and it made me think of Michael Mann's Thief as well. Very similar, the character in Thief putting a magnetized drill onto the vault and drilling into it. So as this is going on, you know, we see the beginning of the Joker's kind of twisted pathos, as it were. He places live hand grenades into the hands of most of the people in the bank and pulls the pin there on the hook for moving or doing anything if they choose to move. Probably they'll drop the grenade and blow up. Since this is a mob bank, the bank manager has a shotgun, and he gets up out of his office with the shotgun, and he starts blowing away some of the bank robbers, and he's yelling about how this is, don't you know who runs this bank? And so the Joker hides. I think he kills one of the Joker's guys, and there's a brief battle here, and then his gun jams. The Joker shoots him, and he goes down. Then inside the vault, as another one of the bank robbers gets inside the vault, the guy behind him kills him, obviously, because his job is completed. Now we're at the end of the heist, and all the money is there, and it's the Joker and this other guy. And the other bank robber draws down on Joker, thinking that he's next in line to die, but the Joker kind of maneuvers him towards the front of the bank, and this enormous school bus crashes into it and basically kills the guy. The bus driver comes out, they load the money, Joker kills the guy. Then there's a brief exchange between the bank manager, who's still alive but seemingly paralyzed. You know, there's this notion of, like, criminals in this town used to believe in things, honor, respect, blah, blah, blah. What do you believe in? Joker pulls off his mask, and we see Heath Ledger, our first, you know, view of the Joker. And his great opening line is, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stranger, which is a great origin for the Joker, of course. Places a grenade in the bank manager's mouth. Pin is connected to a cord that's on the Joker's gun. So the Joker gets in the school bus, and as the bus drives off, the pin is pulled, but the grenade is, and I can't figure this out, whether it's either a dud or it was just a smoke grenade. I can imagine it being a smoke grenade, as the Joker is, you know, quite the trickster, as we will come to see. And at this point, the school bus pulls out of the bank and into traffic, right in the midst of, you know, a dozen other school buses exactly like it. Again, this is the first instance of what are absurdly perfect ways that the Joker's ridiculously Rube Goldberg-like elaborate plans come to pass. You know, they just work out so well most of the time. at the end of the day, it's a comic book movie, right? But I don't know. I didn't have this difficulty in Batman Begins. But so that's the end of this sequence. So now the next sequence I like to call An Evening of the Dark Knight. We get the camera now flying through Gotham, and it is evening, and we get this brief montage of information. The mayor is being interviewed on a talk show, and the host of the talk show, a little Easter egg, is Anthony Michael Hall of The Breakfast Club and lots of 1980s comedies. So the mayor's on the show. He's telling the talk show guy that, you know, the major crimes unit is closing in on the Batman, and as we pull out of what we think we're watching the show, we're actually watching it on a television. We're in MCU, and we meet two cops who names are Wirtz and Ramirez. Wirtz is the male cop, Ramirez is the female. And there's a funny joke where Ramirez is like, hey, you know, Wirtz, I hear you're closing in on the Batman. And he's like, well, the investigation is ongoing, and the camera closes in on like a corkboard. And we see a funny corkboard. It's like Batman suspects Elvis, Abe Lincoln, and the Sasquatch, which is kind of funny. Then we cut to the roof of the MCU, where Gordon's standing next to the bat signal, which we saw at the end of Batman Begins, and Ramirez gives him some coffee, and we get a little bit of an info about her, that her mother's been checked back into a hospital, which will come into play later. Gordon tells her that Batman hasn't shown up, but possibly because he's busy, and then we cut to him actually being busy. So the next sequence is in a parking garage, where the Scarecrow is talking to one of Gotham's mobsters. The character's name is Chechen. Guy looks like a very young Robert De Niro. It's very interesting. Chechen has brought dogs in case Batman shows up. And then the other van opens up and Crane emerges in his Scarecrow mask. And basically the deal here is that Batman has shut down so much of the drug supply in the city that you know the mob can only buy from Scarecrow. And Scarecrow's drugs kind of incapacitate the mob's customers. So Chechen's line is like, my business, to repeat customers. And so the idea of Scarecrow is like, hey, if you don't like the product, don't buy it. Assuming Batman's left anyone to buy from. So during this exchange, they're opened up on by Batman copycats wielding guns. And immediately we get a throwaway line by Scarecrow. That's not him. And, you know, we as comic fans know Batman does not use guns, so definitely not him. So Chechen releases his dogs, who take down one of the copies. Scarecrow takes down another with a shot of his fear gas. He's got this, like, wrist emitter. It's kind of cool. Then the tumbler comes smashing through a barricade, and everyone opens up on it. Obviously, it's, you know, too well armored. And then there's a shot of inside of it. You know, we see that it's being remotely piloted, and it shoots a few rockets, you know, scaring folks. And then we finally get the emergence of Batman. One of the copycats is walking forward, toting this rifle, and we see a hand suddenly come up or suddenly come down and bends the barrel down. And we see that it's indeed Bruce who takes him out. And then we get this brief fight scene with several of the mob members. And finally, you know, and Batman Begins, none of the fight scenes were shot well enough for you to really see how Batman fights. Finally, this time, you know, there's some notion given to how he takes people down. So the fighting style that Nolan and company adopted for Batman is called the Kesey Fighting Method, or KFM. And it's a real fighting method. You can Google it, and there's tons of videos on YouTube showing it in action. And it's a really intriguing fight system where it's sort of the cultivation of a person's natural instincts in a fight. Most of the fights in KFM fighting is you're covering your face and using your elbows and your knees and feet to disable the enemy. And it seems like what you continually come back to is your hands over your face as a natural way to cover up. But from that starting position, you venture out. And it's really mostly about, you know, taking guys' limbs down and blocking and intercepting punches and kicks that are thrown. It's really neat. So I highly encourage anyone to check it out. And so in this sequence, you get to see KFM in action. And actually, it's really cool to watch him. It's very precise and kind of scientific, the way he's kind of taking these guys down. And it always stems from how they're attacking him. Really, really like this sequence. So then Scarecrow attempts to pull away in a van, but Batman jumps on. He's hanging on the side, and he's got this metal cutter in his hand. It's kind of cool. And he begins to cut into the van. But Scarecrow kind of swerves near a pillar, and Batman's dashed up against it, falls off. And so the van heads down this spiral ramp. Batman kind of stands up, looks down for a cool pose, and we see one of the copycats watching him. And he sort of waits a beat and then drops, and he lands right on the top cab of Scarecrow's van, you know, stopping it in its tracks. Really neat. Then there's a brief epilogue. Everyone's tied up. Batman's got everyone kind of locked down. Cops on the way. He sort of chides the clone, the copycats, like, don't let me see you out here again. And we get their response, like, what gives you the right to be here? And his funny answer is, I'm not wearing hockey pads. It's a little clunky, you know, a little bit of the on the nose. What gives you the right? What separates you from me? You know, like, it's the on-the-nose themes that'll pop up in this film as we go. But it's a cool sequence, a nice way back into Batman's world. Before I go any further, what I want to talk about is briefly is how this movie is set up. The act structure in this film, I think, is a little different than most films in that it's really several short films kind of stacked on top of each other, which this film is relentlessly entertaining. And I think rightly deserved the accolades that it got and the money that it made. There's rarely a dull moment in this film at all. And I think it's because the way it was structured is just, it's mini movie after mini movie, you know, that wrap itself up, story after story that wrap itself up. And when the mini movie stories wrap up, the next shot is usually the beginning of the next mini movie. So I'll narrate this as we go, but it's kind of a fascinating part of this film. For me personally, it's part of the reason why it's my least favorite of the trilogy, and I know that will cause howls of derision from anyone listening, but that's kind of how I feel. So the first mini movie is called The Downfall of Organized Crime, and it starts with a bank investigation. The bank the Joker has hit, we're there now in the daytime. We're reintroduced to Jim Gordon. Gary Oldman again, reprising his role, arrives at the bank, and a Batman appears soon after in the vault with Ramirez. So what we learn here is that the cops have been making drug bars with lightly irradiated bills, and where these bills will end up flows back to the banks that the mob is controlling. Very clever. You have to wonder if any of this technology is, was investigated by in real life, because it's a clever idea of actually finding out where money flows. You know, they're talking about at this point. Batman dismisses the Joker. So this initial, what I call mini movie, is not about the Joker. And even when Gordon mentions the Joker to Batman, he's like, you know, one man or the entire mob. So they're going to decide to raid all of the mob banks. And basically, if they can prove that the irradiated bills are in all of the funds, they can seize all the mob's money, and that's it. They'll shut them down. At this point, Gordon mentions that he has to bring in the new district attorney, who is Harvey Dent. There's this trust issue. Batman asking Gordon, do you trust him? And Gordon's not sure, but he has to be brought in anyway. Something about Batman in the bright light of this vault that I don't like. He looks wonky. The mask is different. The mask is a different shape here, or I don't know. It's slightly different in this shot. And he hasn't gotten his new suit yet. This is supposedly the old suit, but there's just something wonky about the way he looks standing there in the bright light that I don't like. Maybe, you know, Batman in a mundane scene is less interesting than Batman in like a night Batman scene when he's in control of every element. I'm not sure, but he looks kind of like a goofy little bird than a bat. But anyway, he pulls his disappearing act, and then we cut back to his penthouse where he's now staying in the city because Wayne Manor, as we remember from the previous film, has burnt down. Is being rebuilt. And so he lives in this really ritzy penthouse, and Alfred emerges with breakfast, but of course he's not there. And then we follow Alfred as he journeys to the temporary Batcave, and he goes to this cordoned off area of the docks, and he enters what looks like a huge dumpster. And in fact, he pushes a button and it goes down. And now you're in this really cool underground sort of bunker. It's got this concrete floor and concrete sides, but the entire ceiling is illuminated by these white squares. It's really neat. I mean, it's a really cool place. I think the set design is really awesome. And so we see Bruce stitching himself up from the dog bites that he got the night before. We hear him talk about how heavy his armor is, and that's weighing him down, and he needs to be faster. And Alfred mentions that, you know, you may want to speak to Fox. And obviously, you know, he would have come to that on his own. They talk about the copycats, and, you know, Batman says it's not exactly what I inspired when I wanted to inspire the people of Gotham. And then, you know, he's got all these screens with all these television channels, and we see that he's following the new DA. And it's our first shot of Aaron Eckhart as Harvey Dent. And we also find that Harvey's dating Rachel Dawes, who is not played by Katie Holmes, but in fact by Maggie Gyllenhaal. So then we're talking about Alfred looking at his body, about know your limits, Master Wayne. And Wayne saying Batman has no limits, which is kind of the thesis statement of the film, or one of the thesis statements of the film. The difference between what Batman, the symbol and the legend, can take and what Bruce as a man can take. This theme will definitely be dealt with on the nose, as the Nolans tend to do. but it's stated pretty early on. So now we cut to a courtroom. The ever-assistant DA, seemingly Rachel has not gotten a promotion in however many years, so the glass ceiling exists even in fiction, ladies and gentlemen, waiting patiently for her boss, Maggie Gyllenhaal. We also meet Sal Maroney, played by another 80s stalwart, Eric Roberts. The Nolans love the 80s actors. They resurrect these guys. It's really kind of cool, actually. So there's Eric Roberts sitting there. He is Sal Maroney, who's taken over the Falcone sort of crime family. Now the Falcone is probably back in Arkham, crazy or dead. And in comes Aaron Eckhart as brash-faced district attorney Harvey Dent. And so he chides Rachel briefly, like, were you afraid you were going to have to step up, Rachel? And we get this bit of fire from her, and Harvey offers to flip a coin, which one of them should interrogate, you know, this witness on the stand. We're introduced to his coin flipping, which is kind of, you know, becomes a thing in this film. And his statement is that he flips the coin and, you know, he obviously wins the toss. But he says, as I recall, it got me my first date with you. He makes his own luck. So, you know, all these themes are being kind of shoehorned in together about Harvey and Rachel. From earlier statements, it seems like Dent has a home run witness on the stand who's going to finger Maroney to be head of the family and finally put Maroney away. But when he actually questions him, the guy changes his story. Maroney smiles. He's obviously gotten to him. And he says that he's been the head of the family and he's running the organization and so on and so forth. And Dent says a little something to the judge, you know, can I treat the witness as hostile? And the witness stands up and pulls a gun, which misfires. Dent grabs it, punches him in the face, and then he walks back to Maroney, basically field strips the gun in front of Maroney, and he's like, carbon fiber, made in China. If you want to kill a government servant, Mr. Maroney, I suggest you buy American. Ha ha. The judge then wants to adjourn, but Harvey's like, Your Honor, I'm not done. So, I don't know. It's a little much for me. It's a little like, wow, you know, Harvey Dent's amazing. He's perfect. It's incredible how fearless he is and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's a crowd pleaser for sure, but I don't know. Tonally, I realized I was in a different movie, I think, at this moment. Afterwards, Dent and Rachel are walking down the courthouse and, you know, she's kind of cheeky and fun, like, you just try to get killed. And she's laughing like, hey, if they're not trying to kill you, you're not doing your job right. And I feel like her performance lacks, I just feel like Maggie Gyllenhaal was miscast in this film. I like her, actually, in a lot of things, but it just lacks gravity. She's like high school acting in this, you know, it's very, you know, she's a little too cheeky. I mean, I didn't love Katie Holmes, but I think Katie Holmes at least gave Rachel, you know, some seriousness and some center in the first film. And I think Gyllenhaal, to me, she's a weightless character, largely because of the way Gyllenhaal plays her. Unfortunately, I don't know that any other actress could have done much because in this film, Rachel is really, really marginalized. And she's basically, you know, the damsel in distress and much more of a stock female character, which is a shame because they really had a nice way of developing her in the initial film where there was no token about her. She belonged in that film and was a pusher of events and made great sense. But in this one, you know, she's just there to be terrorized and saved and loved and, you know, eventually blown up. And I find it kind of creepy and I don't like it. So then we get a brief conversation between Gordon and Harvey Dent. Gordon's in Dent's office, and Gordon needs sort of signatures in order to hit the banks. And, you know, Gordon's kind of denying that he works with Batman. Harvey knows he's working with Batman and wants to meet him. Gordon calls Dent Gotham's White Knight, which obviously, you know, that will change. Then Harvey says, well, you guys got another name for me down at MCU. And Gordon's like, oh, I don't know what that means. And that's a little seed that will come to play later on. So then we cut to Wayne Enterprises. There's this boardroom meeting taking place, this guy named Lau, and there's talks of his huge company merging with Wayne Enterprises. There's a shot of Bruce Wayne asleep at the meeting. When the meeting's over, one of the managers kind of remarks to Fox that he's kind of embarrassed by Wayne falling asleep and, you know, that his trust fund is being replenished, so on and so forth. Reese will come into play later. And then we get a brief conversation between Wayne and Fox. Fox doesn't think Lau's company is above board. Wayne agrees. and the deal is off. At the end of this conversation, Wayne pulls out some sketches that he wants a new bat suit. He wants to be able to turn his head. It's clever because I think I would imagine that they, you know, being on set filming in the costume, that, you know, maybe for practical reasons, Bale and company were like, you know, I can't even turn my head in this damn thing. That may have made its way into the script, which I don't know. I the way the Nolans tend to work, I wouldn't be surprised. But anyway, it's kind of cool that the reason he wants a new suit is not just because this is a sequel and everything has to be new, but that his initial suit is he's finding the limitations of it and he wants something new. So I kind of like that. We cut to this really expensive restaurant in Gotham. Harvey took Rachel there. It took him like months to get a reservation. Wayne walks in with this prima ballerina. He owns the restaurant. They put tables together. They dine together. And the centerpiece of this scene is a discussion about the Romans appointing dictators when the city was under siege, you know, and talking about the Batman. Everyone at the table is basically, you know, voicing disapproval of Batman as a force in the city, except for Dent. And Dent's like, Gotham's proud of a citizen who stands up to crime. So Harvey talks about how, you know, in ancient Rome, when there was a crisis at the gates, they suspended the constitution, elected a dictator to handle things. And of course, you know, Rachel points out that the last dictator never gave up power. And so we get the real thesis line of this film, which is, quote, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain, end quote. You're not going to miss that one because it's going to come back at you at the end of the film. The takeaway from this scene is that Bruce is going to throw Harvey a fundraiser because he wants to. Dent's like, I don't come up for your election. He's like, one fundraiser with my pals, you'll never need another cent. Because he's seeing in Harvey a way to end Batman and make crime fighting in Gotham City a legitimate enterprise. And he will fund Harvey Dent to sort of take his place. It's kind of a cool idea. So now we're introduced to the Joker and the mob. Now meets during the day, like in the basement kitchens of restaurants. First, we start the scene with the mob, and Lau is reporting to them. They put this television on the table, and Lau is basically on a plane, and he's reporting on the Joker's robbery. And he also knows that due to sort of Maroni's well-placed sources, that the Gotham police are going to raid the mob's banks like that day. And he's already acted. He's taken all the money out to a secure location. And then we cut away to Gordon and a SWAT team entering one of the banks, and we see that all that's left of the money are the irradiated bills. So obviously we know there's some inside information was given. So at that moment, the Joker enters laughing, and we hear Zimmer's sort of one held string note, because that's his theme. It's a really twisted but cool moment when he enters, and one of the mobsters there sends sort of his buddy over to take care of him. The Joker slams a pencil into the table, and when the guy comes to grab him, he takes his head and slams it down, and the pencil disappears, right? So, you know, it's amazing. In a PG-13 movie, you can have a guy being killed by a pencil being driven through his eye into his brain, and you don't see any blood or any of it, actually. But the effect is still the same. It's very riveting. And then you have Ledger, right? The emergence of the Joker and wonderful, flat newscaster delivery. It's really creepy and awesome. And he's the legitimate star of this film. He's head and shoulders above. Two ways, I think, in what he's given to do. He's given these two or three soliloquies that are probably the best written things in the film, and the places in the film really where an actor gets to stretch, and there's very little place in this film since it's such a story engine where any of the actors get to stretch in any way. But he is given those places. He's also given the lines, and then it's his own prowess as an actor. It's an incredible trifecta, and you know, it really, he is the life in this film. Basically, he tells the mob that Batman's gonna get this guy, and he'll find out where he is and the money. You know, he offers to kill the Batman for half of the entire mob's savings. There's a great line. There are many great lines in this film. And Maroni's like, well, if it's so easy, why haven't you done it? And the line is, quote, if you're good at something, never do it for free. Eventually, Gamble, one of the mobsters, is like, had it with him, gets up, and the Joker opens his coat, and we see that he's wired with these grenades all kind of connected together with the pin in his hand. So Gamble puts a price on his head, $500,000 for him dead, $1 million alive, which is a plot device later on to get Joker in to see him, and Joker vanishes. So now we're on the roof of the Gotham City Police Department. We see Gordon and Dent arguing. And Gordon is blaming Dent for the leaks that led to the money being taken. Obviously, you know, if you've seen this film multiple times, we know that it's Wirtz and Ramirez really undermining Gordon's entire operation from the beginning of the film onward. So Batman shows up And he finds out that basically they need Lau back from Hong Kong to testify. At some point, you know, Gordon and Dent are arguing a point, and then when they turn back, Batman vanishes. Dent looks at Gordon, and Gordon's like, he does that, which is kind of clever. So now we get into preparations for the Hong Kong scene. We're in, I think, an underground sort of weapons area or weapons storage area in Wayne Enterprises. So I think we see this in the next film. And basically, there's this great line where Bruce is asking Fox about, you know, jumping from an airplane. Fox is like, oh, you know, from your user request, this is pretty straightforward. He goes, what about getting into one? Fox is like, I'd recommend a good travel agent. Another funny line. And then, of course, Wayne says, without it, landing. And he's like, that's more like it, Mr. Wayne. They talk about this Project Skyhook that the CIA has, you know, supposedly invented for getting their people out of hotspots. And I went and looked it up, and actually there was and is such a thing. It's called the Fulton Surface-to-Air Recovery System. Look it up on Wikipedia. And it's exactly as it's, you know, portrayed in the film, where a balloon is used and a plane, you know, going by actually, you know, hooks the thing. And so very cool, you know, kudos to the Nolans and Goyer for pulling something out of the real world. Really neat. And in the same sequence, we see the new bat suit. So the plates are more segmented, and which makes him more vulnerable to knives and gunfire. But we also, the new thing is on his forearms, he has these ejecting spikes. So basically he can press a button and they shoot out from his forearms. And he does it without realizing what it is. And there's a funny line where Fox goes, perhaps you should read the instructions first. And there's another line about the suit doing good against dogs. And Fox says, should do fine against cats, obviously foreshadowing, you know, the arrival of Catwoman, whether they knew it or not. This gets set up, and then Alfred finally devises an alibi for Bruce, and he basically absconds with the entire Moscow Ballet on this boat. And while he's on the boat, a sort of a float plane comes, picks him up, and takes him to Hong Kong. And then we intercut to a scene between the Joker and Gamble, who's the mobster who put a bounty on Joker's head. So the Joker and his henchmen sort of enter Gamble's hideout by saying, we captured the Joker. And of course, the Joker wakes up and takes him hostage. And then we get the first of two sequences where the Joker does, do you know how I got these scars? And he does this whole little monologue about the scars. And again, you know, Ledger as an actor is given room to run here, and he nails it. It's a great conceit. You know, at first, this is the first time that we're hearing it. We think, oh, that is how he gets his scars. And the Nolans really play on this. Later on, we'll see that. So that ends with you know, him killing Gamble, breaking a pool cue in half and throwing it on the ground, and him saying to Gamble's men, you know, we'll have tryouts and there's only one spot open. So obviously they're going to fight, and the winner of the fight, who's still alive, will join the Joker's gang. And so now we cut to our Hong Kong sequence, and beautiful shots of Hong Kong really definitely put you in the place. Fox arrives at the building where Lau Enterprises is. He checks one of his mobile phones in, which is, you know, given deliberate time in the film. And he meets with Lau on the roof, basically telling Lau, you know, we've decided not to go ahead with the merger. You know, Lau's like, hey, a phone call would have sufficed. And it is kind of an odd thing. But as he's leaving, the guard who took his cell phone offers it back to him, and he shows the guard that he already has one, so that cell phone is left behind. Obviously, it's going to be part of the plot to come. And then we get Fox explaining to Bruce about this new technology that's been developed, using, you know, cell phones for kind of sonar, which can map an environment, which is kind of cool, which we'll definitely see put into action later. It's not put into action now, but some discussion about it. So the main action sequence is pretty crazy. It's evening in Hong Kong. He's dressed up as Batman, and with some kind of gun, he shoots these sort of time delay sticky bombs onto a window. And we see him setting the time for 2 minutes. The cell phone that Fox left behind is activated, and probably an EM pulse is generated from the phone or something. That the whole building goes dark. So there's basically no electronics in the building, except there are some lights remain on, but I guess, you know, they have backup generators. There's a beautiful scene where, you know, he leaps off the top of a nearby building and, you know, extends his bat wings and slowly flies into this window and takes out a couple of Lau's guards because Lau is in there, you know, kind of holed up. And he finally takes Lau prisoner, and the police are coming. So there's a bit of tension, and then the window blows out, the one that were containing the sticky bombs, and he shoots out this balloon with a little blinker on it that goes up into the sky, and then we see this plane coming in low, and it's basically Skyhook, and, you know, it hooks onto the balloon in the line and pulls Wayne and Lau out of the building, which is just really great. Really crackerjack action scene, you know, without a doubt. So now Lau is back in Gotham, and we have Rachel interviewing Lau, and she's just out of place. She just seems very childlike and not at all like an assistant district attorney. Just, you know, when I see her acting in this film, I just think, you were miscast. She has no real storyline in the film. Rachel drives none of the action in this film at all. She's there to be the girlfriend of Harvey Dent and Bruce and to cause the two men to, you know, love or to do things. And then she's killed. So because Lau agrees to testify, they arrest all of the, basically all the entire mob, and they're all in this one restaurant. They arrest them all, and we hear Chechen mumble, you know, the clown was right. We should have hired him. The mob's all in prison. Now we see the judge reading the charges. They brought all the mobsters in there. There's a Joker card appearing in her papers, and she doesn't know what it is. She throws it aside. So this ends sort of the mob section, the mob mini movies, I call it, right? The action to finally get the rest of the mob off of the street. Again, it's a nice beginning, middle, end all in of itself. What it will do is activate the Joker full time. And the next mini movie I like to call The Joker Rises. And it's set up immediately because Dent's talking to the mayor, and the mayor's telling him, you got to remain squeaky clean or this whole thing doesn't work. Other than that, you know, we got him. And as the mayor walks to the window, a Batman copy who's been hung in his bat suit slams right into the window. And boom, we're off into the next film, the next sequence. And this is done several more occasions. You know, there is no rest for the wicked or for anyone else in this film. And this is how these mini scenes go. There's not really much in the way of scenes. The Nolans and Goyer, really, every scene is a kind of plot story delivery system. There's very little in the way of actors actually acting other than to deliver their lines and you're out. Other than the Joker. I mean, the Joker gets the long scenes in this film and really no one else. For my taste, just so many short scenes, so plot heavy. The film's not really opening up to me. And I recognize also it's not nearly as elegiac as Batman Begins. You know, they're opening up the scope to be much wider. It's including a lot of city agencies and it's definitely more of a crime epic, as it were. But because of that, they really have very little time to develop any characters because there are so many characters. And so you're just getting so many short scenes and short sequences. You know, it's relentlessly entertaining. And then the Joker will come on screen and will all of a sudden the film will take on a different tone. But I don't know. Something already in this film, when I saw it, I just thought, like, it was just absolutely too much coming at me. And as a viewer, where do I rest? Where do I absorb? So now we've got the second one of the mini movies, I would like to call. I call this one The Joker Rises. It starts off with Bruce preparing for the party he's going to throw for Dent. He goes to the TV and he sees the dead copycat hanging from the window. And Joker had sent in to the media a video of him talking to the copycat while he was still alive. We hear the copycat saying, you know, he's a symbol that we don't have to be afraid of you. And Joker was like, no, you actually do have to be afraid very much of me. And it's done very like ad hoc and, you know, shaky cam. And it's creepy and really good. You know, then we get the setup of this mini movie. The Joker is going to kill people every day until Batman takes off his mask and reveals himself. And the Joker pretty much drives almost all of this movie with his games. And this is sort of the Joker's first game, as it were. Dent arrives at the fundraiser, and Dent bumps into Alfred. And we get a foreshadowing of Rachel's death quite plainly, if you're paying attention. When Dent says to Alfred, oh, you've known Rachel her whole life. And Alfred says, not yet. It's needless, right? It's a really odd response, and I think it really calls attention to itself of, like, you know, she's dead meat. We get a little bit of the setup for this section as well. Rachel and Bruce are talking, and basically he's saying to Rachel, remember that time I told you when Gotham doesn't need Batman anymore? You know, it's coming. Harvey is that man. That day is coming. So then, you know, Harvey walks out into the balcony, and he says to Bruce, you know, you throw a hell of a party. Thanks a lot. You know, Bruce made this little speech, and everyone applauded. And I don't like the line he says to Bruce, hey, mind if I borrow Rachel? And I feel like that's how Rachel is used in this film, as kind of a, you know, a plaything for the men, which kind of sucks. Now we get a sense of the Joker's death game into play. Gordon gets information that the card pinned to the copycat that was killed, there were traces of DNA found of Harvey Dent's. Judge Cirillo, who is the woman we saw, who when indicting the mob, there was a Joker card in her papers, and Commissioner Loeb. We know those are the Joker's targets for that evening. And This is the first sequence of, you know, so much of this movie is Gordon vectoring the cops to chase after, you know, the Joker's what he's doing. And, you know, it gives the film a ring of legitimacy. But, like, I feel like poor Gordon, all he's doing is, like, you know, yelling at cops to do this and do that around the city, you know, for like 3 days. So he starts things in motion to protect him. And there's a little mini cross-cut kind of climax where we're shooting. It's between the Joker after Dent at the party, the commissioner with Gordon, and the judge. We see the commissioner killed because it looks like the Joker put acid in his alcohol. So when the commissioner took a drink, I guess burned his throat or his body, killed him. The judge is put into a car by the police. She doesn't know where she's going. She's supposed to open up envelope, and as she does, there's something written in it that just says up, and her car explodes. In the middle of this cross-cutting, we have Harvey asking Rachel to marry him, and of course, she doesn't have an answer for him, and he says, I take that as a no, and she's like, no, it's just not an answer. Bruce comes up behind him, puts him in a sleeper hold, knocks him out, and throws him in a panic room to protect him from the Joker because the Joker's arriving. And while that's happening, the Joker basically arrives with his gang at the party scene and threatens an old man, and Rachel steps up to distract him, and now there's this, you know, a second character scene with the Joker and Rachel. And of course, again, you know, Rachel's just there. He's abusing her and kind of, you know, mashing her face with his hands. And what sequence is, he says, you want to know how I got these scars? And he tells her a completely different story. They won't be heard in the first time. And we realize that the Nolans are playing with this notion that someone like the Joker has or even needs a backstory that makes any sense to his character. And I like that a lot, actually. I think it's really clever because you don't need a backstory for fucking everybody. It's like we're in a backstory era. Obviously, the Star Wars prequels, which are the egregious backstory of Darth Vader, who is a perfect villain, needed none. But, you know, everyone does backstories for whatever reason. The Nolans recognize, I think, as I do, it's not necessary a lot of the time. So it's kind of neat that they do it in this way. Of course, there's a brief moment where, you know, Batman shows up and there's a brief scuffle. Joker takes Rachel hostage, because that's her point in this film, and drops her out of a window. Batman, you know, jumps out after her and saves her. Then we get a brief shot of Gordon and Dent with Lau. They throw him a bulletproof vest, and there was like, you know, the place is coming apart, but we got to get you to testify. Now we get the sequence back at the sort of temporary Batcave, and we get this fundamental struggle between the Batman and the Joker, which I think is great. There's a story that Alfred tells Bruce, because basically Bruce is looking at shots of the Joker and saying, like, you know, he's crossed the line, the mob has crossed the line. We get the information that, you know, he pushed the mob to such a point where they had to turn to a man that they couldn't understand. And Bruce says, you know, we just have to find out what he wants. And Alfred already kind of understands who this guy is. He tells a story about he and his friends. So we get a sense that Alfred was, you know, in the military at some point or was kind of a mercenary. We don't really know. But they were in Burma. There was this bandit that was, you know, robbing caravans and stealing precious stones, and that they couldn't find anyone who traded with him to get the stones. And, you know, he finds a young child playing with one the size of a tangerine, that the bandit was just giving them away or dropping them. It was more that it was good sport or fun. And then we get this great line that says, some men just want to watch the world burn. And at that moment, we get this nice repeating sort of, you know, mini GIF in a way on the screen of the Joker's face kind of emerging and disappearing, emerging, disappearing, of him laughing. And it's great. And it's actually a really excellent fundamental, you know, excavation of who the Joker is, that he is an agent of chaos, and that, you know, this isn't like Ra's al Ghul, who, you know, or the mob, who, you know, where Batman can understand these criminals because they want things. Ra's wants to, you know, right wrongs and have justice, and the mob wants money and control, and that the Joker is unlike anyone he's ever faced before, and that all he wants to do is create chaos and insanity on the streets. So really cool sequence. So now we get a little kind of mini sequence, what I like to call, you know, Batman finally being a detective, right? In the comics, he's often dubbed the detective. Actually, Ra's al Ghul calls him the detective a lot of times. You know, he's often been dubbed the world's greatest detective. And in these action-oriented Nolan films, and even in the earlier sequence of Batman films and sequels, you know, not much detecting is done. He's more of an action hero. So there's a little bit given to that. We get this really nice sequence, and one of the few that kind of harken back to Batman Begins, where Batman's standing alone at dusk on a building. Beautifully shot, and we hear the Joker's little note playing underneath everything. And he's listening to various frequencies all throughout the city. He hears the Joker's voice giving an address saying that you're going to find Harvey Dent there. So he gets Gordon, and they get to the address, and there are two men sitting there in these uniforms, and one has the first name of Harvey, one has the last name of Dent. Ha ha, Harvey Dent. They were both shot, and Batman realizes one of the bullets they were shot with has embedded itself into the plaster wall. So he takes a little device and removes a chunk of the wall with the bullet in it. Gordon says something like, "What are you going to get, ballistics off a shattered bullet?" And Batman says, "No, fingerprints." And there's also a clue in that moment. There's a the Joker had printed an obituary in the next day's paper of the mayor. So we realize that the mayor is next on his hit list. So now we get, you know, his big high-tech detecting scene. He mocks up other pieces of the wall and he fires bullets into it from this huge gun, analyzes the sort of the scattering of the bullet. And then he finds one that scattered in the exact way that the one did at the crime scene with the help of Fox. Basically, they've taken these electronic scans of the shattered bullet embedded in the plaster. And when the virtual bullet has been put back together again, we see there's a visible fingerprint, which was on the bullet when it was pushed into the clip, which is very clever. It's ridiculously preposterous, right? But it's clever. And it doesn't take very long. But it's, you know, Batman being a detective, which is kind of fun. So now we cut back to a guy named Cameron Reese, who is the guy who kind of chided Fox on Bruce Wayne falling asleep in a conference. And he's sitting with Fox. Basically, he's discovered in doing a lot of the accounting and research into Wayne's, you know, how the business is doing, he's discovered all the diverted funds and applied sciences, and he discovered some blueprints of the Tumbler. So he realizes that Bruce Wayne is Batman, and he says to Fox, I want $10 million a year for life for me to keep my mouth shut. And so then Fox puts it back on him, and he's like, so let me get this straight. You think that your employer is a man who, you know, by night pummels criminals into pulp, and your idea is to blackmail this man. Good luck, right? And I think it's a great way that the writers have, like, the writers don't shy away from dealing with some of the more difficult aspects of Batman, right? I mean, they go after him not killing, and they make it a big deal. And they also exploit, in this film, they exploit the weakness of that. And that's to come a little bit later on. There is this notion, right, in superhero life that's like, you know, Clark Kent, right? He put glasses on. He's like, oh, I can't tell the difference. They go right at it. Like, what if someone found out, they figured out that Bruce Wayne was Batman? They go right at it by saying, so your plan, you know, is to become, in a sense, a blackmailer with this character. And it puts you back on the viewer like, oh, yeah, imagine, you know, I'm gonna try to extort a crime fighter, you know, like maybe not the best idea possible. So it's very clever. I like it. And I like that they went right at it. We get a tease about a government telecommunication project. Fox doesn't even know about this. And this is going to come later on and will be part of the later part of the movie. So now we're in the sequence where an attempt on the mayor's life is made. The fingerprint that they got off the bullet leads them to an apartment overlooking the main street in the city where the mayor's parade is going to be given. And, you know, it's basically a parade for the commissioner and the judge and, the two people who had died. It's daytime, so Bruce leaves the sort of temp bat cave without his costume on high-performance motorcycle, which is a brief foreshadowing to the bat pod, which will come later. So we get the tension starts to build. The mayor starts his speech. Bruce finds the apartment of the gentleman with the fingerprint. He sees it filled with cops that are tied up and their uniforms were taken. The Joker's little note is starting to play and the tension's rising. And Gordon is desperately looking around to see what's going on. The mayor stops his speech and there's a gun salute begins. And so there's some shots fired. Wayne goes to the window and there's a little timer holding a shade. And the timer rings and the shade pops up. And the cops think that the shooter is in the window, and obviously it's not. It's Wayne, and he almost gets killed. In that moment, Gordon sees that the Joker and his men, posing as the cops doing the shooting, they all pivot to take aim at the mayor. Gordon tackles the mayor and apparently takes a bullet for him and is killed. So then there's chaos, and the Joker and everyone and all the other cops lose themselves in the crowd, except one of the guys who's taken and handcuffed to an ambulance. In that moment, Harvey and Rachel are separated. Harvey kidnaps that one of the Joker's men who was handcuffed to the ambulance. He sees that on the guy's name tag, the guy's wearing a name tag called Rachel Dawes, and we realize that that's going to be their next target. Harvey loses it, like he flips out. And it's the first inkling we have that Harvey actually does have a darker side, because we get none of this up until now. And we also see cops at Gordon's house telling his wife that Gordon has died. And Batman is also there. And so she looks up at Batman. She's like, you brought this on. It's your fault. And so all the cops gather at the roof of the GCP and they turn the bat signal on, but doesn't show up. So Batman goes into a nightclub and grabs Maroni. And then we cut to basically Harvey telling Rachel to get somewhere safe, that she's, you know, that the Joker's targeted her next. She tells Harvey Bruce's penthouse is the safest place in Gotham, and she's heading there. So now we have Batman and Maroni. Now we get filmmakers turning their lens on Batman's weaknesses and his little peculiarities, where he has Maroni and he's threatening. He's like, Maroni, where's the Joker? And Maroni's like, you know, the word's out on you, buddy. You have rules. And no one's, you know, Joker's got no rules and no one's going to cross him for you. You know, he's got Maroni held out a window and he's like, hey, if you're going to threaten a guy, you should take me up a, you know, a few stories higher. Fall's not going to kill me. And Batman's like, I'm counting on it, you know, and he basically throws him out the window, breaks his ankles or his legs at some point. But again, you know, Maroni's not going to cross the Joker for Batman and he knows he's not going to get killed. And we see the beginning limitations of Batman's no-killing stance, which this film goes head-on with, which I think is great. So now Harvey has taken the Joker's man into this dark alley. You know, he's like, where's the Joker? Where's Rachel? And the guy doesn't know. And Harvey takes out his coin. He's like, you know, I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to leave it to chance. And he starts flipping the coin. And obviously, you know, we're thinking if the coin comes up on a bad side, guy's dead. Second time he uses it, Batman intervenes and, you know, we get this dialogue like, what do you expect to learn from him? He's a psychotic. Anyone has seen this little scene, everything that we've achieved would be undone. Batman tells Harvey, listen, you hold a press conference tomorrow. No one else is going to die because of me. I'm going to unmask myself. And Harvey's like, you can't give in, you know. And Batman's like, you know, I'm done. So we set up the press conference. So now we get a brief scene between Bruce and Rachel. We now are seeing that the limitations of Bruce, and Bruce realizes that he cannot beat the Joker without becoming, you know, what he has sworn not to become, right? Even back with the League of Shadows, when he wouldn't kill that guy to sort of graduate, you know, he was telling Ross that my compassion is important. It's what separates me from them. But he realizes that he really can't beat the Joker with his limitations, that, you know, everyone's kind of figuring out, you know, what he can't do and using it to defeat him. And he's losing his potency, which I think is great because it's forcing the writers to come up with different ways for him to be effective, which I think is clever. So now he puts Rachel to her promise. Listen, I'm going to unmask myself tomorrow. I'm done. You promised that when Batman was retired, we'd be together. And, you know, she doesn't seem that excited about the deal. There's a kiss between them. So as the audience members, we can realize that, you know, oh, she's torn between two men. So then we get Bruce packing up the Batcave with Alfred and they're burning all kinds of things. And Alfred disagrees with his decision. He's like, endure, take it. This is what Batman was made to do. You can take on the things other people can't. The symbol of Batman can take on anything. And obviously this will be something that he comes to at the end of the film, but he's not there yet. At this point, though, Bruce can't do it. Then we have the press conference, at the end of which, you know, Harvey claims he's the Batman, and he's taken into custody. And now we have this the setup for this chase sequence. You know, Rachel comes to sit with him in the back of his van. She doesn't understand what he's doing. And then you have Alfred explaining it to her as if she's an idiot. It's like, oh, we have to explain it to the dumb girl that, you know, the moral difficult choices that men make. Don't you understand this, you know, young thing? And it's just, that's how I read it anyway. I didn't like that she was the one who didn't understand it. When I feel like the filmmakers wanted to explain it to the audience and they chose to do it through Rachel, and it just kind of pissed me off. She gives a note to Alfred and says, will you give this to Bruce when the time is right? Because she's a little done with Bruce that he allowed Harvey to, you know, admit that he was Batman. He didn't step up and sort of say, no, he's lying. It's actually me. I am Batman. So she's kind of like, he's a coward. You know, how could he do this? And so she's kind of done. She's like on board with Harvey now. But there's a cryptic notion of like, you know, when should I give it to him? You'll know when the time is right. And there's a big goodbye between her and Alfred. And you're like, okay, you know, she's done. So now you have the big chase sequence in the middle of this movie, which is pretty great. As an action sequence, it's pretty incredible. Harvey is basically being transferred in the back of this, you know, armored van to county jail. The Joker is closing in on him with all of his henchmen to try to kill him. So before, you know, the chase starts, Harvey and Rachel have this big kiss, and obviously they'll never see each other again. And boy, do you know it, because they linger on it. He flips his lucky coin to her in a sense, she sees that it's heads on both sides, right? And makes make your own luck, haha. They're driving Harvey to the jail, and there's this burning truck in the middle of the street that seemingly is diverting the convoy down into the lower level. As you're watching the film, you're like, they're not that stupid. They wouldn't, you know, they realized that it was the Joker. They could have just basically made a right and went around the block and kept going. So there's a lot in this movie. I think more in Batman Begins. Look, at the end of the day, right, they're comic book movies, but the filmmakers are trying to make it as realistic as possible. And I think in Batman Begins, they largely succeed in mixing the harder-to-take elements with realism. So I don't know. The mix works for me. Whereas in this film, you know, there's still a grittiness and a realness to things, but I'm asked to take, I think, too many things on faith within that world. And this is one of them. It's like, oh, we have to divert down to lower fifth, they say, right? We'll be turkeys on parade down there. It's like, there's no reason they have to do it, you know? So it's a little too convenient for the script, but whatever. You know, it's an action movie, so if you're in, you're in, if you're not. So the Joker's pursuing in two vehicles. He himself is in a large semi in the back, and then there's a garbage truck that's driven by some of his henchmen. Basically, the side of the semi opens up, and the Joker and his men are there. They're sort of parallel to the armored van. They open up on it. Of course, the van takes the shots. And then, you know, there's a lot of good comedy. The Nolans know how to do action sequences with injections of comedy really well. You know, one of the drivers of the van is like, they're going to need something a lot larger to punch through. And in the next sequence, one of the Joker's men hands him an RPG. The RPG is used. It takes out the lead cop car. The Joker reloads, takes out another car. And then the tumbler arrives from ahead of them, goes head-to-head with the garbage truck, basically going right into it, and the garbage truck kind of upends over and on the tumbler, which is really cool. Takes it out of the fight, and then turns around. Now it's giving chase. And then there's a tension scene where the Joker sort of is bringing the RPG to bear on Dent's van, and right as he fires, the tumbler goes into sort of bridging mode, and it takes the RPG on itself. It's fatally damaged and is out of the fight, but for the moment. So now we follow the tumbler as it crashes through a wall, and it's fatally damaged. So Batman pushes some buttons, and basically what's created out of what's left of the tumbler is what's called the Batpod, which is really a kind of brutalist version of a motorcycle, as the tumbler is kind of a brutalist version of the Batmobile. It's a really neat machine with these huge wide tires, which were the tires of the tumbler. Very clever. How it comes together is a little nuts, but whatever. It comes together, and off it goes. It's got these huge machine guns on it. You know, he's off and giving chase. And at this point, the armored van, you know, wisely realizes that they should kind of head for the surface for some air support. And they get up there, and then we see from the point of view the Gotham police choppers are coming. Then two of the Joker's men basically shoot cables across the intervening space, and the chopper kind of, you know, goes into the cables and crashes and burns. And again, at that point, and I'm not a big nitpicker in movies, you know, I'm willing to go with a movie, but, you know, how did they know where the van was going to get up, that the Joker's men were waiting at the exact spot where the armored truck would decide to come to the surface? They would know that it's taking too much for things to be just that perfect. And the Joker really, everything that the Joker does, however unlikely and Rube Goldberg-like it is, always works perfectly. There's something about that that's getting on my nerves as the film goes on. As what happens in this film a lot is, it's so cool that it outweighs the absurdity of it. And you just keep going. So the Batpod is basically blowing up everything in sight to try to catch up. And now for the kind of climax of this big scene, the Batpod is coming at the semi, and it shoots cables into its sort of its engine compartment and runs past it. The cables get jammed into the ground, and Batman kind of flips around on the Batpod and, you know, returns the other way. Very cool sequence. And the entire semi flips over in that great scene that we've seen from the trailer and everything else. Really awesome. So the Joker emerges with a gun. You know, Batman's now heading towards him in the Batpod, and you know, the Joker's muttering under his breath, like, come on, I want you to do it, I want you to do it. It's a great scene. Kind of, you know, because we realize at certain points in this movie that the Joker doesn't mind dying. He's not sort of a chaotic character and also trying to survive unduly. Like, yeah, he tries to survive because he has more things to do. But, you know, I think it's successful that I believe that in certain moments that the Joker's willing to die. There's another sequence later on where that happens, and I buy it. But of course, you know, Batman cannot betray his principles, and he swerves at the last minute, crashes the Batpod, and he's seemingly unconscious. And as the Joker arrives to sort of finish him off, the driver of Dent's van, who was up until now covered, pulls off his mask and he puts a shotgun to the Joker's neck, and it's Gordon. So Gordon basically faked his death to sort of take, you know, any notion of him being around out of the fight, surprise the Joker. On one last note, Dent tells the police, "Are you working with Batman?" "No, but I trusted him to do the right thing and save my ass," because, you know, he knew he'd be the target of the Joker. So kind of cool. But we see him being driven away by Wirtz. There's the camera kind of focuses in on Ramirez afterwards, and we know something's up because she doesn't look too happy. So this next sequence, I call the, you know, the Joker wants to be captured, the next kind of mini movie. It's part of the Joker's master, you know, for an agent of chaos. You know, he has these TikTok plans that never fail, right? The Joker's in prison. The mayor, in front of everyone assembled, promotes Gordon to commissioner and says the words, "Commissioner Gordon." It's kind of weird. And we see the Joker also clapping to congratulate him. They hold to the mystery of the Joker here. You know, his prints don't come up anywhere. They don't find anything, any ID on him, which is kind of nice. And as a brief intercut moment, we see this large man being introduced into a jail cell, a cop killer, but he's obviously crazy, and we're not sure why he's in the movie yet, but we're going to find out soon enough. So now we have the interrogation scene between Gordon and Joker in an interrogation room, and, you know, there's a lot of cops on the other side of two-way glass watching the whole thing. And we find out from Gordon that Dent is now missing, that no one knows where he went after he sort of, you know, was driven away from the last scene. And Joker kind of jokes around, like, "Can you trust your men, Gordon? You know, are they really your men?" Gordon realizes he's going to be playing around with him, so he undoes the cuffs, and he's like, "I got to go get a cup of coffee." And the Joker's like, "Oh, is this good cop, bad cop routine?" Gordon's like, "Not exactly." And he leaves the room, the lights go on, and we see that Batman's been standing behind him, slams his head into the desk. So then we get Batman and the Joker, which is a really juicy part of the film. You know, they face off against one another. And Ledger is given room as an actor, and he's given some wonderful dialogue to, you know, test himself on. During this sequence, when we're cutting back to Batman, for whatever reason, we see these two lights in his eyes. And it's like his whole dark face, but these two lights burning in his eyes, I guess reflected from a light behind the Joker. It's really cool, actually. Joker's speech is what the Joker is, right? There's some truth. There's always some truth in the Joker's speech to what he's saying. That he's like, you know, "They're going to cast you out. You're all alone, Batman." He's wrong about what people are, which the end of the film will sort of prove. And he's kind of a little bit right about Batman being cast out, which he will be at the end of the film. And in the middle of the interrogation, Batman's kind of, you know, beating up the Joker a little bit. The Joker lets slip that he has Rachel, and Batman loses it. He puts a chair in the doorway to hold it open, and now he's going to town on the Joker. And the Joker's laughing at him. He's like, "You're going to have to break your one rule if you're going to want to save her, you know." And the Joker's like, "You have nothing to threaten me with. You think these rules you have are going to save you, but they're really not going to." And we see Batman's frustration. It's like, you know, without the willingness to kill or break his moral rules, the Joker will not give an inch. And it's great because it's just, you know, these are his limits. At one point, the Joker's like, "Okay, I'll tell you where they are." And he gives Batman two addresses. He bursts out of the room and he tells Gordon that he's going after Rachel. Gordon and the Gotham City Police Department will go after Harvey, obviously. And so now you're going to get a cross-cut sort of climax sequence where Batman is heading towards what he thinks is Rachel's location. The Gotham PD are headed towards Dent's location. At the same time, the Joker now is trying to get himself a phone call inside of the holding cell. And we're getting dialogue between Rachel and Harvey. There are open radios between them. And so getting this is very like Perils of Pauline, man. You know, woman tied to the railroad tracks, which a lot of this film really goes and plays with a very melodramatic fundament. They're wired to explosives. It's very comic booky. We find out that Rachel tells Harvey that, you know, the answer to your question that you asked me before is yes, a resounding yes, that she would marry him. When Batman arrives at one of the locations, we realize that the Joker has tricked him and he has swapped the location. So Batman actually arrives at Harvey's location and the Gotham police are on their way to Rachel's location. But of course, Batman being the speedier of the two, you know, gets Harvey out. Earlier, Harvey had tried to get free, falls on the floor, and his face is soaked in gasoline. So one side of his face is soaked in gas. And when he pulls Harvey out and Harvey's building explodes, you know, half of his face catches on fire, which is kind of clever. In the comics, you know, he's basically in the comic books, it's a very similar setup in the beginning of this film. when Maroni's guy on the stand pulls a gun on him. In the comics, instead of the gun, it's acid, and he's actually scarred in the courtroom by one of, you know, the mob's thugs and becomes Two-Face. But in this way, this is how they do it, and so we see in a really cool effect shot, half of his face burning. Of course, on the other end of things, Rachel, you know, blows up and dies. And then a little bit of the Joker's, you know, perfect plan back at the precinct. There's a guard, you know, standing guard watching him inside the interrogation cell, and he provokes the guard into kind of beating him up. Of course, he gets the drop on him, and, you know, he's like, I just want my phone call, and somebody throws him a cell phone. When he dials the number, the large man who was thrown into the cell earlier is being looked over by two people because he's, you know, complaining of, like, stomach pains. And we see that there's a cell phone under his skin and this wire. And we realize that he, as a person, has been wired with explosives. And so he detonates, blows up the whole sort of detention area. What's really strange about this, it's a very clever thing to do. Somehow the Joker is the only one who's not harmed. And I don't understand how that's possible. You know, he walks around sort of the holding tank afterwards by himself. Everyone else is gone or incapacitated. Somehow he's survived. It's just an odd moment. And also Lau has survived, who's in a cell, and the Joker walks up to him and says, hello there, and obviously he's going to take him out. And we cut back to Gordon, who realizes that Rachel has died and Harvey has been saved, but that the Joker's gone with Lau. And then the Joker tells us, the audience, as he's saying it out loud, he planned to be caught all along, this was his plan. I don't know. At that point, this film really has kind of gotten itself into a very strange place. You know, it still goes for the realism of things on one level, and on another level, it really is elevated to comic book action, I guess, more than anything else, and not much character development, you know, full-on scenes. So it's relentlessly entertaining, as I'll get to when I summarize, but I don't know. It's just, it's too perfect. The Joker's plans are too perfect for me. However, just when I thought it was safe to think that this movie was going to be, you know, easily written off, there's this wonderful elegiac montage now. We see the Joker in the back of a black and white cop car, and the sound drops away, and it's just the Joker shaking his head out of the window, you know, getting air, exhilarated by the rush of his victory, and it's a very powerful image. And in the same montage, we get this wonderful shot of Batman standing kind of like this statue on, you know, what could have been the wreckage of 9/11, frankly. And now we get a voiceover of Rachel's note, which she'd given to Alfred. Basically, the note to Bruce telling him that she realizes there'll never be a time when he doesn't need Batman, and that she's chosen Harvey over him. Batman, we see him finding Harvey's coin. One side is now blackened with soot. As the voiceover ends, Alfred is placing the letter in Bruce's sort of breakfast tray. And Bruce is sitting there still in costume. And, you know, they're all trying to process Rachel's death. But when Alfred hears that Bruce believes that Rachel was going to wait for him, he kind of pulls back her little note. And Bruce is like, what is that? And he's like, well, for another time. And it's a nice echo in the breakfast scene from Batman Begins as well. He's like, I thought I might prepare a little breakfast, right, when he's a kid, which I kind of like. In desperation now, Bruce is like, you know, Alfred, how did you and your friends catch this bandit? And Alfred says, we burned the forest down. And the next scene, we see Dent waking up with this sort of burn graft on his face. And again, the sound drops away like in that brief Joker scene. We watch him screaming at the top of his lungs, but we don't hear him. And it's very powerful, really amazing. And then he picks up the coin because Bruce had visited him to drop the coin off. And he now has his coin, and his transformation into Two-Face is beginning. So now we enter into another mini movie, which I call the Cameron Reese and the Hospitals movie. And we start off straight away. Cameron Reese, the guy from Wayne Enterprises, goes on television and he's threatening to reveal Bruce Wayne's identity. So we have that beginning tease, which kicks off the movie. And then Gordon goes to visit Harvey Dent in the hospital. Through Gordon, we hear that Harvey is refusing all pain meds and skin grafts. And Harvey forces Gordon sort of to say out loud the name that they use, the other name they use for Harvey down in MCU. And he says Harvey Two-Face. So he is named. And we finally see the burnt side of his face for the first time, which is really pretty good CGI. You know, it's not the most realistic thing, but it's pretty close. And we also see that, you know, his utter hatred of Gordon and his determination. You know, there's this chilling line when Gordon says, I'm sorry. And Dent says, no, you're not yet. Gordon leaves, and all of a sudden he bumps into Maroney on the outside in the hospital, and Maroney says, look, this is too much. We're going to give you some information about where the Joker is going to be. Then we cut to the Joker in some undisclosed location, and he's made a pyramid out of half of the mob's money that he was promised, and Lau is sitting at the top. The transfer of power is pretty much complete. The Joker is now taking over organized crime. Chechen, the gangster who's there, basically walks up to him, and he's blown away by the fact that all that money. And he tells Chechen, tell your boys they work for me now. And Chechen says they're not going to work for a freak. So basically he sentences Chechen to death by being, you know, cut up and fed to his dogs. We see men pouring gasoline on the money and they're beginning to burn it. There's a great line where the sequence ends where it's Joker saying, everything burns. Here's the interesting thing about this scene. I think in our hyper-capitalistic society where, you know, everybody's a brand, everybody has a podcast, right? Me included. Everyone has a website. Everyone has this. You know, the selling of ourselves is sort of insane. That the burning of all this money is like the most transgressive image in this film. You know, we've seen all this violence before, but like, you know, an American film that celebrates the burning of a pile of cash. Of course, he's the villain, right? But still, I find that a very transgressive image. And I think it's really, really subversive and interesting. And while he's standing there, he calls into the talk show that Reese is supposed to be on, and he sets another mini movie in motion by, you know, playing another game. If Cameron Reese isn't dead in an hour, he blows up a hospital. So now we're on. And of course, we cut to Gordon, who's like, call this guy, evacuate that guy, bring people there. You know, he's doing his city cop delegation shtick yet again, you know, as the Joker is calling the shots. There's a lot of this film is really Gordon kind of being used to kind of task cops around to make things look legitimate because he's using words like ICU and MCU and I don't know. He seems to mostly now just send police around to catch up to the hero and the bad guy, and they usually have little effect. Bruce now departs during the day. He leaves Alfred. He tells Alfred to investigate all of Gordon's men, find men with family in the hospital, and he heads off in a Lamborghini to try to protect Reese personally. They bring Reese out of the TV studio, and a citizen takes a shot at him, so they take him out the back, and now he's in police custody. So he's in a police van during this ride. It's basically Gordon, Reese, and two other cops. Alfred finds out that one of the cops in that van has a wife in the hospital, and they text it to Gordon, who starts to, you know, to talk to the guy. At one point, two things happen at the same time. A guy on the outside in a truck realizes, you know, that's the truck Reese is in, and he makes a beeline for it. Bruce gets in the middle of it with his Lamborghini, and at the same time, one of the guys sitting in the van with Reese tries to shoot him, but Gordon prevents it from happening. After this brief climax, Reese comes out of the van, and he realizes that Bruce Wayne has saved his life, and we get a sense that, you know, the brief moment of Reese, you know, ratting him out is over. So now we get this wonderful scene in all its creepiness. They've evacuated Gotham General because of the Joker's threats. So he walks in there and kills the police guarding Harvey, dressed in a nurse's uniform. And it's comic and horrifying. It's really a brilliant move. Dent's restrained, so recognizes the Joker. And again, you know, Ledger is now given a scene and lines to act, which not a lot of people are given in this film. We get this notion of, you know, plans and planners and the Joker being an agent of chaos, which I find patently absurd when the Joker's clockwork plans are the things that are being executed to perfection. But, you know, that's a nit. There's a great detail. Joker is wearing a Dent campaign sticker on his uniform. In this point, again, I think at this point in the film, again, Joker is prepared to die because he frees one of Dent's hands, puts a gun in it, and he's basically trying to ruin Dent. And at one point, you know, he's like, be an agent of chaos, and he puts the gun to his forehead, and he's willing to, you know, let Dent kill him to set Dent on sort of his downward spiral. But Dent, of course, doesn't kill without the coin at this point, so he flips the coin, and Joker wins the toss, and he comes up alive. And it's a great scene. There's some really interesting music playing underneath when the Joker's kind of giving Dent his philosophy of life. You know, it's a quiet, wonderful scene in it's all its creepiness and intenseness. As the Joker is leaving the hospital, he pulls out a detonator and triggers it, and we see the hospital starting to explode. Everyone has been evacuated. he walks out into the street and he has this weird, cool little duck walk. He's just, he looks like this bizarre, you know, comic man in a nurse's uniform. It's very bizarre. There's a funny part where, you know, the hospital doesn't blow up completely. And he's looking at the detonator like it's broken and he's triggering it. And like he throws his hands up in the air. It's very physically funny, you know, like his movements and the way it's all done. A genius. Of course, he does get it to work, and then we get this shot from like way up. They really blew up a building. It's an extraordinary explosion. Gotham General blown to bits. So now we're in the end gambit. This is the last mini-movie. I call it the Ferry sequence or the game theory sequence. It kicks off. The talk show host Mike Engel, who's played by Anthony Michael Hall, is captured by the Joker. And he's reading something the Joker put in front of him, setting up the next game, as you will, for the Joker. And the Joker's telling the city that he owns the city, and anyone left inside the city after dark will be sort of fair game for him and his men. And then he tosses off this line about the bridge and tunnel crowd being in for a surprise. So the notion is now that, you know, Gotham City itself is going to be evacuated, but they can't use the bridges and the tunnel, so how will they get the people out? Cut directly to Batman's, I think it's somewhere in Wayne Enterprises. It's his version of burning down the forest. And he basically has taken Fox's cell phone sonar technology and he's wired it to every single cell phone in Gotham City. And basically he can image the entire city and eavesdrop on it as well, and giving him like godlike surveillance. Pretty cool, right? It's the notion of that's his burning down the forest. He's leveling the playing field to find the Joker. And Fox, who is, you know, one of our consciences in this film, protests that it's wrong. Says, as long as this is here, you know, I won't be, but I'll help you this one time, of course. Because, you know, Bruce is like, we have to find this man, Lucius. We have to find him. So he leaves and he says, you know, you're the only one who can use this. And when you're done, type in your name. So we get a little sense of what that's going to be. Now we are also following Dent as he's bent on vengeance. He trails Wirtz, who's the guy who drove him to his date with the explosives and his burning face. Wirtz is in a bar drinking. Of course, Harvey kills the bartender and then confronts Wirtz, flips the coin, and Wirtz loses, and Harvey kills him. But Wirtz doesn't know who the other driver was who drove Rachel, and so Dent's still out looking. Then we also see that the Joker's bridge and tunnel threat is forcing people to get out of the city via the ferry. Gordon plans to on the very first two ferries to leave. One of them is going to be full of all of the criminals that you know, Harvey put behind bars, because he feels like at some point they may be liberated and used in whatever the Joker has planned. And in the other ferry will be the first group of civilians. Then we have Maroni in his limousine getting out of the city. Dent is in the back seat with him. Maroni tells Dent that Ramirez was the woman, and it's the, you know, the female detective that we've seen close to Gordon the whole film, who drove Rachel to her date with death. Dent does his coin toss with Maroni, and Maroni wins, and then he does the coin toss with the driver, who loses, and he shoots the driver. The limo flips, and Dent's the only one who walks out, so we're assuming that Maroni is also dead. And now we're getting shots of the ferries being loaded and departing, and night is falling on the city, and then we see the power fail in both of the boats. And these boxes containing detonators are delivered. And then we hear the Joker on the PA setting up the scene. And the notion is that at midnight, Joker will detonate the explosives in both boats unless one of the boats detonates the explosives on the other boat, which will then save their boat. So it's kind of a game theory type of thing. I think they call it the prisoner's dilemma. It's kind of similar. However, as he's speaking, Fox, using the technology, the sonar technology, triangulates him, and Batman is set on his tail, and Batman calls Gordon, and they meet at this building opposite of where the Joker is kind of hanging out. Then we cut back to Dent, who forces Ramirez at gunpoint to lure Gordon's wife and children out of their house so he can kind of get his hands on them. And she survives the coin toss, which is, I don't know, I just found that odd. So she does not die. We're back then across from the building the Joker's in. Batman and Gordon they can see that there are hostages and clowns in the building across the street. To Gordon, it looks like it's a slam dunk because it's like a shooting gallery. They can see both of them. And of course, Batman is telling him that with the Joker, it's got to be more involved. It's not that simple. And Gordon is kind of freaking out right now. He's like, I have to save Dent. He's convinced that the Joker has Dent with him. and wants to attack right away. And Batman asks him to give him 5 minutes. Of course, you know, Batman does his jump and his fly, and Gordon tells his guys 2 minutes. And then we cut back to the civilian ferry. They're taking a vote about what to do about the detonators. So we see that. And then we flitch to the convict ferry as well. They're kind of looking at each other and wanting to rush the main men to steal the detonator, but they're held off. Now we get sort of endgame and an escalation of Batman's abilities. So what happens is he flies into a couple of floors down below where the Joker's men are. These screens drop down in front of his eyes, and the screens now, he's using the sonar technology as well for his eyes and ears, so he can see through walls, and he has sort of this virtual, you know, readout of sort of everyone. So we basically got clowns and hostages and SWAT team members. So he begins, you know, this endgame. So basically he realizes that the Joker has, his men are masquerading as hostages, and the clowns are the actual hostages. So if the police open up on the clowns, they're going to kill all the hostages. So Batman discovers this. So his task here is he has to take out the real terrorists, the real clowns. He has to take out the SWAT team, and all without killing everyone or anyone. At the same time, the SWAT team is you know, dead set on killing the clowns, which are actually the hostages. It's really an impossible situation, and yet we see him do it. Although, you know, I don't follow it as well. I see a lot of action on the screen, and there's a lot of sequences where he shoots guys with his grappling gun, and you know, winds up taking them down and hanging them up instead of killing them. So it's kind of an impossible series of events that I never follow really well. But he achieves his goal. And at the end, the SWAT team realizes that the Joker has made the switch, and so they're on board, pretty much ending that standoff. And then we cut over to the boat, and the civilians have voted to blow up the convicts. And so now we get the climax between Batman and the Joker, and the Joker's on this floor protected by some dogs. Batman arrives, Joker sets the dogs on him, and Batman's taken down by the dogs. And while he's sort of struggling, the Joker's kind of having at him with a metal pipe, smashing his helm and his body. We cut back to the convict boat, and one of the biggest, meanest-looking men on that boat begins to try to convince the guy in charge to give him the detonator. On the civilian boat, they voted to blow up the convicts, but no one has the stones to kind of actually do it. So this main one of the guys we've seen on the boat, who's kind of been the catalyst to do things on the civilian boat, basically like, well, someone's going to have to do this, and I guess I'll do it. So he kind of gets up and heads for the box. Cut back to Batman. And the Joker's assault has damaged that sonar, and so he can't really see anything properly. And he's looking around, and he can't really see the Joker. And Joker has the advantage, and he incapacitates Batman and pins him beneath some structural framework. Then we also see that Gotham police have secured all the hostages, so that's done. Back on the convict boat, the main convict convinces the guy to give him the detonator. And in a nice, you know, turnaround, he tosses it out the window, which is kind of I think it's a really cool moment. Back to Batman and the Joker. He's waiting now for one of the boats to explode, because obviously, you know, he's like, when people are in the situation, they're going to, you know, they'll kill to survive. And it comes to midnight, and of course, nothing happens. Because we see on the civilian boat that the one guy who was about to take the detonator and blow up the convicts can't do it. So the great climax of this movie is that, you know, no one's doing what the Joker expected, and his whole notion about, you know, humanity is flawed, and Batman kind of feeds him his own line back about, you know, being all alone and outcast. So Joker attempts to detonate both of the boats, but Batman pulls out his new sort of gauntlets that shoot, knocks the detonator from the Joker's hand, and kicks him out of the floor where he's holding him, and the Joker's sort of plunging to his death. But Batman shoots his grappling gun at him, saves him, hauls him back up, and we get their last little dialogue. Joker's hanging upside down, and he admits that Batman is incorruptible, but that his victory lies elsewhere, and that, you know, he wasn't. It's a great line where he's like, "I wasn't about to bet on the soul of Gotham on a fistfight with you. Like, Dent was my ace in the hole." The way they shoot the Joker at some point is, you know, he's hanging upside down, but the camera turns around, you know, and shooting him as if he's standing up, and it's like some comment, obviously, on, you know, the Joker's view of the world being so incredibly askew, right? In this case, he is won. He really, even though he is lost in that one instance, he's actually won the game, as it were. So now we have dent with Gordon and his family. You know, me personally, I found this extremely melodramatic and anticlimactic. I liked the game theory, Joker and the fairies. I really liked that. This whole thing with Two-Face, to me, I seem such an anticlimax that it's a classic end-of-the-movie villain with misguided rage. He's going to do something terrible. And, you know, and thematically, yes, they had to go here. They had to bring Harvey all the way down to the bottom. Take this man who was at the top and bring him down to a threatening, you know, threatening to kill Gordon's children. Something about it, though, it didn't fit for me. It felt like too much, way too much. I hadn't really seen the descent of Harvey. Like, you know, the film has showed me him doing things that were increasingly not so great. But to me, it didn't knit together as really Harvey falling because who knows who Harvey really is? I mean, in a sense, we've seen him in a lot of scenes in this movie, but I never really get a sense of Harvey's character. And maybe that's just a failing of me, but I don't think the film convinced me, first of all, that Harvey was ever really good or that he ever was bad or, you know, it just, he was plugged into the theme of the fallen man. And I don't know. You know, they drag it out and he flips the coin a bunch of times, winds up Batman sort of comes into the scene, but Harvey shoots him. And of course, no one ever remembers that Batman wears body armor when it's convenient. So he can do a Han Solo. And at the very end, he saves Gordon's child and they both fall off of from a great height. Of course, we never get the notion that Dent is really dead. It was never said that. It's very carefully worded about Harvey's reputation, not his life. And I feel like they were, you know, giving themselves an opening should they want Dent to return in the third film. So we do get the interesting end, which definitely is cool, where Batman is going to take on Harvey's sins because the lie, you know, the faith of the Gotham citizens has to be preserved. It's a very interesting notion. And, you know, again, Batman repeats Harvey's line, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. The ending montage is, you know, Gordon's giving a speech memorializing Dent. Destroying the bat signal, Alfred burns Rachel's note, Fox types his name into that sonar machine and it's destroyed. And then the last scene, it kind of comes back in time to that night when Gordon is explaining to his son, you know, his son is, I guess, the audience, right? Well, but Batman is the hero, you know, why are we chasing him, Dad? And Gordon's like, because he's the hero Gotham needs, not the one it wants, and blah, 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 blah. Although there is some real pop grandeur at the end when the last three lines that Gordon gives, Silent Guardian, Dark Knight, and he's riding the bat pod up into the light and we go to black. And it's a real powerful ending, you know. And I do like the ending. I do like the fact that, you know, they're subverting Batman's status. What I do like is they use Batman's as a symbol. They use his symbolism to take on the sins of Harvey Dent, who they can't really afford to show, you know. It's interesting that they're going to base this faith that the city is going to have on them on a lie. It's a very complicated notion that's being played around with right at the end of the film. It's a nice takeaway to walk out of a film and to be thinking along these lines in terms of, well, if it's a lie, you know, you're giving faith to a whole nation, a whole city, but it's built on a lie. What's the point? Is that really necessary? And it's nice, you know. It's a kind of a thorny thing. And so we're out. So The Dark Knight, right? I mean, it's my God, it's most people's favorite Batman movie. Most people who've seen the three movies, they like The Dark Knight the most. It's most critically acclaimed of the three, made the most money of the three, I believe. But for me, it's the least of the three. And for the most part, because of the way it's structured, that it's done in these mini movie segments, there's just so much story going on all the time. You know, there's constantly a little urgent, thrilling story going on. And, you know, in terms of entertainment value, yes, that is huge. And that's why I think for a lot of folks, The Dark Knight is an amazing movie because it just is continually, you know, thrilling you and entertaining you in every moment, right? But it gets tiring. I feel like it's like an addict. It's almost constant action and suspense. And the only time when it slows down at all is when you get the Joker's soliloquies. And that's when Heath Ledger really gets the shine. And I think everyone else in the movie's performance, they're really mouthpieces for the screenwriter. and, you know, agents of the story. Whereas the Joker is, to me, the only real actor and performance in this film. He's given actual scenes to take his time and have some scenes and act and, you know, not have the camera be cutting away immediately because there's another story bump to be given. And so he's really the best part about this movie. The center of this movie is amazing. It is very impressive what they do. There's no doubt about that. You know, what they've constructed here is a very impressive machine of entertaining its audience. There's no doubt. But at the end of the day, it leaves me cold. I don't come away from this movie with anything other than I've been entertained. You know, the themes of Batman Begins and the themes of The Dark Knight Rises stay with me, I think, over time, whereas the themes in this film really don't, because I feel like so much has been shoehorned in that when I'm done, you know, it's exhausting to watch at one point, but I do not really feel compelled by these characters in a large sense. So, you know, definitely an amazing movie in its own right, but not one that I'm overly fond of versus the other two films. So that is my take on The Dark Knight. So this is part two of a three-part series. I'm going to tackle The Dark Knight Rises next, ending out the Nolan trilogy. I want to thank you guys for listening, and you can find me on the web at scifionscreen.com. I'm on Facebook, scifionscreen.com. On any kind of smartphone that has a podcast app, you can search within the app for Sci-Fi on Screen, and you can find me and subscribe, and you'll get new episodes as they arrive every week. That's all for this time, and hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time.